Welcome to the Proper Mental Podcast. Normalizing open and honest conversations about mental health by having open and honest conversations about mental health. Just before we dive into this one, I would just like to say a huge thank you to everybody who downloaded and listened to the bonus episode that I released last week, last Thursday. It was the one with my auntie Chris, and the numbers that I did on that was absolutely incredible. I think for the first day download statistics or whatever it is, it's the highest. It's the most times an episode on its first day has been downloaded. So thank you so much. And that also means we've got a lot of new ears on the podcast. So if you are new, welcome to Proper Mental. Feel free to work your way through the back catalogue and check out everyone who I've spoken to so far. And if you have been with me all the way through, then thank you very much for your support. It's much, much appreciated. So that's awesome. Thank you. But we're moving forward, right? Always looking to the future. So here we are, episode 19. And my guest today is Jake Mills. Jake is an award-winning stand-up comedian, a mental health campaigner, and he's the founder and CEO of Chasing the Stigma. So in 2013, after his own battles with depression and a failed suicide attempt, Jake decided to start Chasing the Stigma, which is a national mental health charity that's committed to normalising mental health. And he's driven that forward to become one of the fastest rising and well-respected mental health charities in the UK. It's absolutely fantastic what he's doing with Chasing the Stigma. And it's all been done by sort of donations. You know, there's no funding there. So Jake and his team have really, really, they've grafted to kind of really build that up from nothing, from just Jake on his own, to create this charity that's going out there and really doing good work. And one of the things that's come out of the charity is something called the Hub of Hope, which if you haven't heard of it, well, then you're about to learn something awesome because it's so cool. So basically, the Hub of Hope, it's described as a groundbreaking mental health database that's become the UK's biggest and most comprehensive mental health signposting tool. And basically, it's revolutionised mental health pathways in the UK. So it's this massive database. And if you go on the website or go on the app and just pop your postcode or your location into the first page, it will bring up all the mental health support and services in your local area. And we're talking everything. So there's the emergency stuff, there's the counselling support services, there is the peer-to-peer support groups, the community groups, there is, yeah, you name it, the charities, the people you can talk to, people you can go and see, absolutely everything. There'll be people there that you didn't even know existed. And, you know, the idea is that when people are struggling with their mental health, different people need different things, you know, and sometimes you need a doctor and sometimes you need a therapist and sometimes you just need a support and sometimes you need to speak to someone on the phone and sometimes online is fine and everyone reacts in different ways. And it can be really, really hard to find the right help at the right time. You know, sometimes it just comes down to just to luck, you know, when you're feeling a certain way and when you need a certain type of help. And we don't always know where to go or who to turn to. But we do with the Hub of Hope, you know, so you can just find there will be something there because there is everything there. And it's just fantastic. You know, we should all know about this. Everybody has mental health. That's something that Jake says. And, you know, you never know when you're going to have to look after it. You know, and if you've never experienced problems with your mental health, then there's a very good chance you know someone that has, or maybe you're worried about a friend or a family member. Because the other thing that's on the Hub of Hope is other services to support you to support someone, you know, so there's the stuff there for the people that are affected by someone else's mental health problems, you know, everything that they're going to need is there too. So it's so comprehensive, it's so big, it's absolutely amazing. And yeah, like vital is the best word for it. We should all know about this app. We should all have access to it because you never know. You never know what you're going to need and you never know when you're going to need it. So yeah, it was fantastic to talk to Jake about this. He's so passionate about mental health. He really, really cares. And he doesn't just want to raise awareness. he doesn't even want to just make a bit of difference. He wants to change things. He wants to change the way that we look at mental health, the way we react to it, the way we talk about it, and the way we look after people as a society, you know, as a system. He just wants to kind of rip up the current rule book and rebuild it so more people can get more help when they need it. And yeah, it's just fantastic to hear about how it came about and to hear him talk about it. It just makes perfect sense what he's saying. And it's a great, great conversation. We talk about his own journey and the stuff that kind of he went through. We talk about how he ended up on national telly and in the press and all this sort of stuff talking about it. And, you know, he just went from, surviving a failed suicide attempt to being on national telly. And then he found himself as like a figurehead of the mental health space. And all the people reaching out to him and stuff like that. And sounds like a bit of a crazy time. We talk about how the charity came about. We talk a lot about the Hub of Hope. We talk about mental health in children and how we can start to make changes from the ground up, you know, by helping the younger people in our lives so they can go on to become more aware of the mental health challenges that the modern world throws at us. It's a deep one. It's a big conversation. And Jake was absolutely fantastic. He was very generous with his time. And yeah, I enjoyed it a lot. And I hope you do too. What I would like you to do before you listen is go to the Hub of Hope, pop your postcode in, pop your location in, and just have a look. See how amazing it is. See how it works. And just have a look around in it, you know, because you might not need it now, but you never know. You know, you never know whether you might need to recommend it to someone, whether you'll need it yourself, whether you'll need it for a family member or a friend. So yeah, just go and have a look, because to see it in action is so cool. When I did it, I had no idea that the Wirral had so many mental health related groups and support networks around here. And I really, really could have done with knowing about the Hub of Hope. When my mental health wasn't doing too good over the last few years. So go and have a look at that. Go and have a play. If you would like to know more about the charity, you can go to www.chasingthestigma.co.uk, or you can find them on social media at Chasing the Stigma, or you can go to www.hubofhope.co.uk or at Hub of Hope UK. If you want to know more about Jake himself, it's at Jake Mills Comedy on social media. And if you want to connect with me and chat to me about anything podcast or mental health related, give me a shout at Proper Mental Podcast in all the usual places. And you know, if you've listened to this one, if you've listened to previous ones, if you're going to listen to future ones, if you could do me a solid and subscribe or leave me a review or any of that good stuff. The aim always with this podcast is to normalize open and honest conversations about mental health. And to do that, I need more people to hear these conversations. And by liking and sharing and reviewing, especially all that sort of stuff, that just means that's getting out there to more people, gets in more people's ears. And, you know, maybe someone who really needs to hear about the Hub of Hope, who doesn't know about it yet, is going to hear this podcast, and that's going to be able to point them in the right direction to go and get some of the help that they need. So let's look at it that way and go and leave me a review. Anyway, here we go. So episode 19 of the Proper Mental Podcast with Jake Mills. Thanks for listening. Enjoy. After we swapped some emails and like booked this, I had Mick Coyle on.
Oh yeah.
And I asked him, like, after out of all the like people he spoke to and all the stuff he's done, is there anything that like really stands out that stayed with him and stuff like that? And he gave me two Jake Mills quotes. And I was like, sick, I've got him on in a couple of weeks. So,
okay. I don't know what the quotes would be. I've said a lot of stuff to.
Yeah, I can well imagine. But yeah, thank you for joining, man. I really, really appreciate it.
We're really happy.
Superb. So I'll just jump in if that's all right, mate.
Yeah, cool. Yeah.
Fantastic. So yeah, joined today by Mr. Jake Mills. How are you, mate?
I am not too bad, actually. I'm feeling all right.
Fantastic. We'll take that, right? We'll take that. So I suppose I found out about you, mate. I kind of reversed engineered it in a way, really. I found the Hub of Hope first, and I was absolutely blown away by it, like how necessary it is, how vital it is. It's really cool. And I thought, right, well, whoever is responsible for this, I'd really like to talk to them on my podcast. And that led me to Chasing the Stigma, which is the charity that you look after, and then back to yourself. And obviously we're going to talk about these things a lot, but just to kind of give them some context, I suppose, mate, I'd quite like to just, if we could go back to the start of your own mental health journey and just talk a little bit about your experiences and particularly how they started to manifest for you, Jake, because I think like how things start for people, that's also where the stigma starts, in my opinion, right?
Yeah. I mean, for me, I didn't know anything about mental health, and I didn't know anything about poor mental health. I didn't know anything about good mental health. And, you know, I've said this often, but stigma is often ignorance and you know, not being educated about something, not understanding something. And that's where stigma comes from, because you fill those gaps and those voids with whatever you can pick up from wherever you can pick it up. And so for me, I didn't know any of the feelings or any of the signs or any of the symptoms of poor mental health. But why would I? You know, I went to an all boys school where it was never talked about. So I just generally never talked about it, never knew anything. I was never prepared. So I didn't know that I was struggling with my mental health, probably until I was really, really struggling with my mental health. I didn't know at a preventative stage. And yeah, you know, my background is in stand-up comedy, and I was performing stand-up across the country, and I was enjoying what I'd done, but I just wasn't, I not started noticing that I wasn't feeling well. That I was just struggling every day, struggling for motivation, struggling to wake up, to face another day. Everything just felt really heavy. And when I was doing stand-up, probably the 15, 20, 30 minutes that I was performing was probably the only time that I didn't feel those feelings. Beforehand, certainly after, certainly the next morning, it just all started again. And things just manifested like that for me, where I didn't think that it was something that I was going through. I just thought it was just me as a person not being able to be an adult, not being able to cope as well as everybody. So I didn't ask anyone for help. I didn't tell anybody, because I thought that people would just say, yeah, you know, this is just, everyone's like that. This is just,
yeah, this is life. Yeah.
Life. This is being an adult. This is what it's like. And so I thought, well, I can't say that, because people just say, well, you're just not as good at coping with life as us. I didn't ever consider being depressed. I didn't ever consider what I was going through was something I could go to a doctor for and I could ask for medication. I didn't think that. I didn't, you know, people ask about getting help and support and, you know, reaching out for help and support, but I didn't think it was something I could get help and support with. So that's probably the biggest barrier, that not being educated, not being prepared, not being able to look out for these things, to know that I could get help and support, was probably the biggest barrier for me.
Yeah, and that's huge. That's huge on both sides, right? Because it stops people. And what you've just said there, that's, you could be telling my story. That's so fucking relatable. That's untrue. And yeah, not only is the person that these things are, the person that's experienced them, don't feel like they can do anything about it. But then even if they do, the people who haven't experienced, they have the same like thought process, right? They say, oh, it's just Jake, he's a comedian, he makes people laugh, how on earth could he be sad? You know, like it works both ways, the same problem.
It does. And also because of that, I just tried not to let that show. Also just noted that you swore, so it's good to know that we're allowed to swear.
Go for it, mate.
You can say shit now. but yeah, it was this kind of, you know, Don't get me wrong, every single day we all put masks on. You know, you get up, you get dressed, you think, am I happy for people to see me the way that I look now? You do your hair, you might put makeup on, you might do all these different things, and you say, this is how I want the world to see me. And that's what we do, and that's normal. But what I was doing was saying, okay, all this internal stuff, I've got to suck it up. And then I've just got to pretend. And that in itself is exhausting. That in itself is absolutely exhausting, and it's quite, it's very damaging, because you're going out there every day pretending to be the person that you want people to think that you are, and then when you're coming home, it's just letting all that go again, and then it's a lot of pressure, and it's very, very heavy. So, even the people around me, probably the people closest to me, certainly as I started to get worse, did notice that I wasn't myself. But there was a long time where I was convincing other people as well as convincing myself that I was okay when I wasn't.
And that, that's because these changes are so small, right? Because a lot of thing that's misunderstood about aspect of mental health is that a lot of people think that there has to be some sort of trauma, there has to be some sort of catalyst, but it's not. Obviously that's a factor for some people, but for a lot of people it's not, right? There isn't that thing. And because it's so incremental, I know that it changed my personality when I was poorly, and I didn't see it coming. I didn't see it coming. I adjusted to the change so much that it just became a part of the new me, which, wasn't a healthy me.
No, and yeah, I would wholeheartedly agree with that, actually, in terms of my own experience, how I tried to, because what you're trying to do is you're trying to cope, and that's why your personality is changing, because you're trying to cope with something that you're not used to dealing with, and you're not actually really dealing with it. Well, certainly I wasn't, and so I was trying to find different ways of dealing with things, and for me, it was just trying to get drunk. Not necessarily problematic. I certainly didn't like drink to get through a day. But I would have a drink to try and enjoy myself. I would have a drink to, if I can go out every night and get drunk and be around, I'll be okay to be around people. I'll be okay to meet girls, and I'll be okay to dance, and I'd be okay to have all that. And then the next day it'd just be worse and worse and worse. And so that was a bit of a coping mechanism for me. But one of the other things, and just on the point that you're saying there, is that I started to get very, very aggressive. And what you've just said is absolutely right, is that before going through what I was going through, I was not aggressive. I was not aggressive or confrontational in any way. I hate any confrontation. I'm just not good at that at all. But when I was going through that anxiety and depression, and then drinking as well, and trying to cope in these different ways, that's often how it came flying out, almost as a way of having to prove myself. Because one of the things I struggled with was that I felt like I was failing as a man. Felt like I was failing as a man, because I felt like I couldn't look after myself. And one of the things that I always wanted was to be a dad, and I thought, how pathetic a thought and idea, because you can't even look after yourself. So how are you meant to have kids? How are you meant to look after the kid? How are you meant to raise a kid? And those feelings came flying out, as I said, as paranoia and as aggression. And I'd start fights with people. I'd start fights with men, because I would think they're laughing at me. One, I'd think that I would walk in and they'd say, look at this, little boy, is how I felt. But also, I thought, well, if I can start fight with a man and throw punches and all this other stuff, then maybe that proves that I'm a man. And obviously, that's not a healthy way, and it got me into different situations. But as you said there, it's the complete opposite of who I was before and who I am now. But it was just this mixture of all these different things that it just changed my personality completely.
Is that societal, do you think? This environment where men have to be stereotypical men, or where do you think that comes from, Jay?
I do think to a certain extent it was. Again, it's filling these gaps and these voids with stereotypes and these, the information that I've had to pick up, I didn't, I don't know really. I went to an all boys school. I don't know if that had an impact on it. But I never, I don't know. I never felt like I had to prove it that like that before. But yeah, you know, I was never, there's never like a lad's lad, you know, and I never watched Top Gear and I can't grow a moustache and all these different things. And I just, yeah, it was just something that, I don't know, it just manifests, doesn't it? You know, this is what happens, is that it just turns into something else and you convince yourself even more and more. And yeah, I was probably always a little self-conscious about it beforehand. But while going through everything, it just manifested into something a lot bigger than it is now. And you know, now I go to the gym, but I still can't grow a moustache and I still don't like Top Gear. So, you know, nothing's really changed.
Yeah,
But I'm
that's
happy
it.
now.
Yeah, exactly. It's
I'm
all
okay with it.
internal, right? Yeah. I suppose as well, if you're using drink as a bit of a coping mechanism, as a bit of a crutch, and you're a stand-up comedian and you're touring around, well, it's part of the lifestyle, right? So you can hide behind that. You're gonna like, oh, it's not a drink thing. It's what I do after a show. It's just what everyone does, right?
Exactly. And but then the other things with that, and probably going back to it as well, is that then that's a pretty unhealthy lifestyle physically as well. So not just the mental aspect, but physically. And then I started to be really self-conscious about my body, about how I looked, putting on weight, all these different things. And it was just, yeah, it was just not a very good time. And yeah, it's very, very easy to hide behind, well, you know, this is what it's like. It's cool, it's good. But then, you know, we're talking about other aspects, you know, financial. It was a struggle, trying to make money traveling around. You're quite lonely traveling around. There's a huge competitiveness when it comes to stand up as well, like there is for many things, but it's a little bit dog eat dog. And then it's trying to have a relationship and a lot of different relationship problems and going in and out of different relationships. So for me, there was a whole range of things that all add up. And when you're unwell to begin with, and then you have more of these things adding up, then you know, sometimes the most obvious and basic and minimal things can be the heaviest and hardest to deal with. And for me, it wasn't like a one-off major event. It was just a combination of a whole range of things, and that I just wasn't very good at dealing with them.
Yeah, sure. I kind of think of it as like it's like death by a thousand paper cuts. You know, they just over time it just adds up and becomes overwhelming, right? So how long did that go on for you, and how did that come into, you being Jake Mills, who has his own mental health support charity?
It's hard to say how long it was, because if you would have asked me 9 years ago, I'd have said, oh, it was only, you know, 3, 5 months. And then you look back at it and you go, well, it's probably 18 months. And then you look back and say, it's probably 24 months. So it's hard to know exactly. And just, I suppose, the more that you learn about yourself, the more that you learn about mental health in general and poor mental health, you kind of, okay, you start to realize a few more things about yourself. But yeah, so basically, the long story short is that I didn't deal very well with my poor mental health, and that led to a suicide attempt 9 years ago, 8 or 9 years ago. And yeah, I just didn't ever think I would be there. Never ever ever thought that I would be in that position. But I felt like I had absolutely no choice. And I was kind of let down by the emergency services, by GPs. I was kind of left to deal with things on my own. But what was different was that because of the suicide attempt, my family knew, and you know, I'd become a very good liar. I lied to everybody. I wasn't a very nice person, and I just lied about not only how I was feeling, what I was going through, where I was, who I was with, all these different things. And that web of lies is what really kind of led to that spiral. After the suicide attempt, those lies are gone. You know, those lies, I wasn't hiding behind anything anymore. I didn't have to pretend that I was okay. I didn't have to pretend that I wasn't unwell, because it was right there. I was at rock bottom. I was at rock bottom. I couldn't have got lower than the point that I was at. And my girlfriend and my mum and my dad knew. It was there. So to hit that point was obviously a very, very low point in my, probably lowest point in my life. But to have them aware of it, to have that bubble of pretense popped and burst, it was probably the turning point in my life. It's probably the most important turning point in my life because I was like, okay, well, now you know.
Yeah.
There it is. And they didn't know what to do, but they knew that they would do something.
Yeah.
So
Yeah.
they just surrounded me. They just surrounded me. They just comforted me. They just worked with me. But the important thing is, it didn't, they didn't get angry. They might have been angry, but they didn't show the anger with me. They didn't show disappointment with me. They didn't show shame. These are all these things that I thought they would feel. This is all the things that I, the reason why I didn't ask them for help, the reason why I didn't tell them stuff, the reason why I would lie and protect myself and protect and pretend every single day, because I would worry about, well, how, what are they going to think of me? And to be at that low point, but to have them say, listen, we don't know what we're going to do, but we'll make sure that we look after you because we love you and we'll protect you. And it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what's happened before. All that matters is that we will make sure you are better. And that, for me, that reassurance was just enough to say, okay. So as I said, I was let down because I didn't really, doctors just said, just double your medication, antidepressants. And yeah, I wasn't really offered any support or anything. So we went away, and when it came back, I decided to speak out about what I'd gone through. And in all honesty, it wasn't to help people. It wasn't. It was just to take control of my situation, because some people had heard about what I'd gone through and were mocking me online or talking about it and gossiping. Did you hear that he tried to kill himself? Do you hear he tried to do it this way? Have you heard this? And people were saying all different things about it not being real and all this different stuff. And I thought, you know what? If I'm going to move on, and I need to take control, I can't hide. I can't hide. And that was personal to me. It's not personal. It's not the same for everybody. But for me, I thought I need to take control of this. So I spoke out about what I'd gone through, and I put it on social media. And as a result, I was overwhelmed by the amount of people who came to me for help. Not just people saying, well done for speaking out, but people saying, I feel the same way. I feel the same way. And I didn't know anybody else did. And people started coming to me saying, people I knew, people I didn't know, people from all over the country saying, I'm going through this. And I was like, okay, here's a bit of an eye-opener of how many people are going through it. And then I was asked to go on television, and I was asked to go on radio, and asked to do interviews for newspapers based on what I'd gone through. And the amount of people who would come to me asking me for help every single time I'd done an interview. The first interview I'd done was on the Lorraine show, I think, and then Owen Jones done a piece for The Guardian, and then I was doing other stuff. And every single time, people came to me messaging me saying, I need help. And I remember being on the train on the way back from London, with my, at the time, girlfriend, who's now my wife. And it was not on the train on the way home, and I said to her, I'm gonna have to do something. I'm gonna have to do something, but I don't know what, but I'm going to set up something, because look at the amount of people who feel the need to come to me asking me for help when I'm not a trained professional. I'm not a doctor. I'm not an expert. I'm just somebody who said I've been unwell and I've come through with the other side. But they're seeing enough in that to reach out for help and support. And that's basically where Chasing Stigma as a charity was born. The idea came on that train on the way home. And the thing that stood out for me was the amount of people who were coming to me asking me for help without going to a doctor, without going to a loved one, without going to a professional or to services. Because every time we were asked,
they would come to me, whether that's through me, it was through my private Facebook, through my email address. I was saying, have you spoken to anyone? They're saying no. And I was like, why? And they said, because I'm worried and I don't, you know, what if I'm judged, all these different things. And I was like, so why have you come to me? Not in an accusing way, just to find out. And they were saying, because you understand. You've been there.
Yeah.
You've come through the other side. And so I realized that the responsibility that I had when it came to speaking about this, but also the power of lived experience to offer that hope to people. And so that's why I wanted to create a charity, and importantly, make it easier for people to find that help and support.
Yeah. I mean, relatability is so huge in mental health. It's so huge because it's so all consuming, isn't it? When you're going through something and people, the amount of people, and it happened to me, the amount of people that think, oh, it's only me, it's only me, it's only me. And then once you start finding out it's other people, and I found other people sharing their lived experience sort of pushed me on to kind of do something about my own situation. And all those people that were reaching out to you, they would have experienced exactly the same thing you did when you didn't want to tell the people around you, right? For all the same fears, all the same reasons, all that sort of stuff. And just to backtrack a little bit, right? Because what I think is interesting is that, you know, it's very easy to say to people to like speak out, but we all know it is really, really difficult to speak out. But once you kind of start doing it, it gets easier and easier. And I think it's one thing telling your mate, right? It's another thing telling like your missus or your dog or whoever you decide to speak to. Going into therapy is hard. It's another thing jumping on live TV with Lorraine Kelly and like telling millions and millions of people. Did that seem like a, you know, was that quite a thing? Was that quite a big jump for you? That's an unusual situation to be in, right?
Yeah. And in all honesty, I say this kind of as I understand why I was asked, but I feel like I was kind of thrown in the deep end a little bit. Because I had charities coming to me saying, will you go on television? This is the other thing, and you know, not everybody understands how the media works, and you know, it wasn't me saying, right, I've spoken about what I've gone through, now I'm going to email the Lorraine Kelly show and say, can I come on and talk about it? You know, and a lot of people kind of think that's how it happens, and it doesn't. But what happened particularly with the Lorraine show was that a large national charity got in touch with me and said, will you go on this and talk? And I was like, maybe. And they said, it'll help so many people. And I was like, okay then. And before I knew it, I was booked. They had the train booked, they had the hotel booked. My wife now, but girlfriend at the time, we were just on the train, and we got to the hotel, and I remember it like we got to the hotel quite late, and you know, they paid for the meal, which is all nice, but there was never any like real prep for me on what this is going to do. It didn't feel like I was going on television, really. It didn't feel like I was going on national telly to talk about everything. So I was quite confident or comfortable talking, that was fine, but I was never prepared for what would happen afterwards, never. And in regards to being asked to do that media, you know, from the charity that I was asked to do for, it was more of a, will you go and do it? And then afterwards, there was not a follow-up, there was not a, are you okay? There was not a, do you need any help and support? It wasn't like, it was just a media up. And I felt like, and I'll be honest, this has happened ever since, is that you're almost rolled in, talk about this horrible time, see you later. And when people were coming to me, asking me for help, they weren't going to the charity that I was talking about. They were coming to me on my personal email, my personal Facebook. I was getting messages when I was sat at home or in my bed. I was somebody who was talking about not being well. So people coming to me, and it, you know, it's only really that, because this was actually about, I don't know, I could probably have a look at dates, but I'd say it's probably about 8 months after the suicide attempt itself. So luckily I was, you know, I was in that recovery. But that was a pretty dangerous situation to throw me, anybody else in, and all the people who come into me as a result. It's in answer to the question, I didn't really appreciate what it was. I didn't appreciate as big a step as it was. But also on that point, just because I spoke publicly about this, just because I've spoken in the media, and just because I'll do podcasts and stuff like this, I'm comfortable with that. Now, when we say about talking and speaking out and speak out about your mental health, it doesn't have to be publicly. You don't have to stand in front of your office, in the middle of your office and say, right, I've got mental health problems, because health is health and it's personal. That's completely personal to you. Like, for example, I have Crohn's disease. I don't talk about Crohn's disease anywhere. I don't really speak publicly about it. I've done that now, but because I go, well, that's just personal to me, and you know, I don't work with those charities, and I don't do anything like that because it's personal to me. If you have any personal health problems, that's fine. As long as you are talking to somebody, and as long as you're reaching out for help and support, that's the main thing. You don't have to do it publicly in order to start that recovery, as long as you're talking to somebody.
Yeah, that's such an important point. And you know, you put it in terms of physical health. You know, if you've got a headache, you think nothing of saying to your missus, "Oh, I've got a bit of a headache, I'm gonna take a paracetamol and go to bed." You know, we think nothing of it, right? And mental health should be the same. And where, like, I think society lets us down, and you know, we talk again talking about stigma and stuff, it's really interesting you mentioned that after your suicide attempt, that people were actually like saying stuff online, you know. And it's like, what if we could create a society where it's really fucking normal just to say, like, mentally, I'm you know, I'm having a bit of a bad day, or I'm having a bit of a patch. You know, why do we have to wait till the shit hits the fan to speak out? You should be able to speak out at the start of that. You should be able to speak out as soon as you feel a bit off, and just be able to say it. And you know, it would be great if we could have this environment where we just get used to saying it, we just get used to hearing it.
Yeah, absolutely. And the only way that you can do it is by normalizing the conversations in schools and workplaces and in amongst your everyday life. You know, we talk to kids about how they're feeling when they're feeling sick. And you know, I've got two kids now, and I'll say to my 5-year-old, and we probably have ever since he was probably able to talk, you know, if he was to say, "I'm not feeling well," we'd ask him, Well, that's okay. Like, tell us, is it, do you have a headache? Do you have a sore throat? Do you have a stomach pain? You know, we ask him, and we encourage him to tell us when he's not feeling well. You know, so we have that with physical health. Really, it's so normal, it's just dead normal, it's part of that process. This is what we say. Remember being in school yourself, if you felt unwell, you'd tell the teacher, you'd say it, you know, I don't feel well, and the teacher would probably just say, "Put your head on your desk," like, that's gonna fucking help, but whatever. And also, you probably would be just like made up just to have your head on your desk. But you've normalized that conversation. And when it comes to mental health, we haven't normalized that conversation. We don't talk about it to the kids. We don't talk about it in school, which then means that we don't talk about it going into our adult lives. So then you have situations where people, even, you know, I'm 33, I think, and I even at 32 or 33, I don't know how old I am, I think 33 this year, I only know about this stuff because of what I went through. You know, my mum and dad only know about this stuff because of what I went through. They wouldn't have any clue. So it's a generational thing. But until we've got it in schools, until we have this type of normalized approach to it in an everyday environment, then we're always going to have stigma. We always will. And we're always going to be at a point where people say, "I don't believe you. This is the situation," because that's what was essentially happening with me when people were talking about it online. And this is something that's happening even now, you know, even in the news not long ago with Meghan Markle, who, you like it or you don't like it, I don't really care either way. But to say, "I don't believe you for you telling me that you feel a certain way," is a bizarre approach. It's a very, very bizarre reaction to somebody saying, "I was feeling unwell."
Yeah, Yeah, it's
I just can't get my head around it.
yeah, it's the opposite of human, right? Like, where's the fucking compassion gone, man? Like, we're supposed to give a shit about your fellow man and all that sort of stuff. And you mentioned kids there as well, and like a lot of children, like particularly generational back in the day, it's like feelings weren't valid unless they were extreme, right? So my little boy might say to me, I'm nervous about going to school, and I've got two options, right? So what I do with Reese is I sit down and I say, well, that's very normal to feel nervous, mate. Why do you feel nervous? And I tell him that sometimes daddy feels nervous when he goes to work, and we make it a, like, we talk about it. Why, you know, why do you feel nervous, all this sort of stuff? Or I could say to him, ah, you'll be fine, come on, let's go. You know, and it's the little things that add up, and it trains us from a very young age that if you feel any sort of any emotion that isn't pure bliss all the time, doesn't really matter. You just got to crack on. It starts that young, right?
Absolutely. And she might not forgive me for saying this, but I recently had a conversation with my mum, who, because my little boy is incredibly shy and nervous, and I was and. We've been trying to encourage him to go to different classes, you know, like taekwondo and things like that. And he just doesn't like it. He just doesn't want to go. And I've always said that, you know, try it. If you don't like it, you don't like it. That's fine. We'll find something that's right for you. And I don't want him to be going in anywhere crying and upset, because what I don't know what that's doing. And my mum actually said one of her biggest regrets is that she would almost forced me to go to these clubs, because she, you know, I think it's quite a normal attitude to have. It's like, well, you'll be all right once you get there, or, you know, once you're there, you know, you'll make friends, it'll be better for them. And I'd absolutely hate it. I would hate it. And she told the story she told the story to me the other day, that apparently when we went on holiday once and went to Spain, and she told me to go to this kids club, and I was probably about 7, 8 maybe, and I was crying, saying I didn't want to go, and she said, no, go, because you'll make friends. And I went, and when she came to pick me up, she said, did you have a good time and all that? And she said, did you make any friends? And I said, no. And she said, did you speak to anyone? And I said, no. And she was like, well, why didn't you do, what a waste opportunity, and all this stuff. Turns out nobody spoke English. None of the kids. Not the teacher. So I was just the only English kid, just on my own. And you know what the worst thing about that is? That I have no recollection of that at all. I've obviously locked that away somewhere. And so my mum says that, you know, if she was to go back, she would not make me go to any of those. Because again, it's saying just suppress those feelings. It doesn't matter. You know, if you're scared, if you're nervous, if you're angry, if you're sad, just, as you just said, just suppress it. You get on with it. Just lock it away. That's not healthy for anybody.
No.
And everybody's different as well. So, you know, if one person feels like they can go to all these classes, this is just an example we're using, or can go to school and they're fine being around people, that's them. That's great. But not everybody is like that.
Yeah, definitely. We need to, I suppose, like, so much we don't understand our own behavior as humans, and then we just do things. It's all autopilot, isn't it, really? You know, we tend to, unless you break the cycle, you parent how you've been parenting, and your parents parented how they were parenting, and all that sort of stuff, which is great. That's nothing against parents. However, like, my folks parented me in the 80s. That's, we're not in the 80s now, right? So something's got to, society's changed. Everything's got to change. We've got to change with it.
The other thing as well, though, is that as an adult, we give ourselves that leeway, and we give ourselves the permission to, you know, just for example, as adults, a lot of adults don't like public speaking, and so a lot of adults will put that as a blocker to say, listen, I'm laying down the rules here. I don't like public speaking, and I'm not going to do public speaking. And we accept that because we say, all right, well, you know, you don't like it, that's fine. And we you know, we put our foot down to say, these are my limits. I don't like doing that. I'm not going to do it unless I absolutely have to. But as children, or as parents raising children, we don't allow them to have those, because we feel like maybe they haven't experienced it, or they don't know because they're only kids. It's the same feeling. It's just that same anxiety that comes as an adult of public speaking, just as an example, where you say, I'm not going to do it because I don't like it, or singing in public, or anything. You'll have things, we'll all have things. We say, I couldn't do that in a million years. But as kids, we say, well, you don't know, so you're going to do it. And
Yeah.
what's that doing to us? What's that teaching us as young people?
Yeah, man, that's huge. And I suppose like with children as well, and I've never thought about it like this, but with children as well, their emotions, their feelings are so much more pure because they're not dictated by what people think of them. They're not dictated by, oh, I need to impress people at work to get a job, or there's nothing outside with kids. It's just raw, honest, purest emotion. It's not been tainted by society. So if they're feeling something, they're probably a lot more in tune to it than when I feel something and I have to kind of unpick it and say, why don't I like this? And it probably might, that could take me like a couple of months of therapy to figure that out, right? But kids are just in it and on it. So yeah, that makes so much sense, man. That's awesome. Yeah, that's really cool. Yeah. So now you've started a charity, right? So you, that must have been a bit of a slog as a one-man band to get that off the ground, right?
It was. It's took a long time. But we are coming up to our fifth year as a registered charity. And as I said, my actual suicide attempt was 8 years ago, I think. So we kind of I'd started shaping the idea and building it before we became a registered charity. And what I was incredibly passionate about was that I didn't want to be a self-awareness, I didn't want to be a self promotional organization, I didn't want to be just about awareness, I didn't want it just to be a vehicle of saying, here's another mental health charity, talk about your mental health is important, here's a poster, here's a campaign, that's it. I didn't see any use in that, I didn't see any value in that. What I always wanted to do was I was looking at other campaigns, looking at charities, looking at adverts, looking at all the stuff, and I was saying, how somebody's life changed? How somebody's life changed as a result of this campaign? So if you look at if you take a person that you're aiming this at, which let's just say is somebody in need, at the beginning of this campaign to the end of this campaign, have their lives changed? Have you made a difference to them? Have you made a difference to them as a person? Have you helped them? Or have you just made them aware of mental health or your campaign or your fundraiser? What's changed for that person? And so everything that I wanted to do was to make a difference for people, individual people. Everything had to be people focused for me. And I wanted to be practical. I wanted to change the system because I knew that it wasn't good enough. All these people who come to me asking me for help have been let down. They've all been let down by that system. Every single year, we talk about 5,000 to 6,000 suicides or over 6,000 suicides every year as if it's inevitable. It's not inevitable. And by treating it like that and saying, oh, well, it's around the same number. So as long as it doesn't dramatically increase, then it's okay. No, that's not okay. It's not okay. We have to do something different. We have to change the status quo because what was out there was just the same things that have been out there forever. And they do a lot of good work. I'm not taking anything away from the organizations that are there, but it's not enough on its own. And so we needed to do something different. And what I kind of quickly realized as a result of people coming to me asking me for help, one, I didn't know where the help was and I couldn't direct them. But two, I looked into the statistics and absolutely tragically, this is the same in the latest statistics as it was back when we started this. But of all the people who die by suicide each year in the UK, almost three quarters of them each year are not known to mental health services or haven't been seen in a year previous to the death. Every single year, three quarters of the people who die by suicide die without getting any help. That's scandalous.
That's heavy.
That is absolutely scandalous. It's a national scandal that people are dying without getting any help. Like take this into any other context and say three quarters of people with cancer die without getting any help. Like we wouldn't accept that. But there's this inevitability about it, and so I wanted to do something about that. So why weren't people getting help? Well, because they don't know where the help is. They don't know how to ask for help. They don't know that they're going through something like what I described before. So they don't reach out for help. They don't know they can get help. And then if they do reach out for help, often at a crisis point, You're hit but with waiting lists, you're hit with thresholds where, particularly in eating disorder services, where people are being told that they're not ill enough, that they're not thin enough, that they're not light enough, and this is incredibly damaging and dangerous. So I wanted to take all that and say, well, how can we change that? How can we make that help easier to find? So I put out an appeal and I said, if you offer any support, tell me who you are. I just went out on my social media to start with and we tried to get some support. And people started telling us about their services and we started to list it. And then I started to go out and research and find more services and I realized just how many there was. And so we took that little Excel spreadsheet and we built it into a website and then into an app with an organization called Mashbo. Based in Liverpool, and we turn that into an app, a free app, which essentially is like the Just Eat of mental health services. Because what I wanted to do was take that same instinct and that, you can travel anywhere in this country, you've never been there before, but if you want a pizza or you want a curry or you want a Chinese takeaway, you go to an app and you find it. You just do that. You can be born, raised, lived your entire life in one city and not know about the mental health support that you've got. So how does that make sense? So we wanted to take that same instinct and make it as easy for mental health support so that alongside the talk about your mental health, which is the thing that we say, you say, talk about mental health, but here's the help and support you can get. And we wanted to do it so it wasn't just NHS support. We wanted to have charities, we wanted to have private support, we wanted to have community groups where you can go and be around people, walk and talk groups, football groups. But mental health related, we wanted it to be together in one place, and we wanted to give people options and choices. We wanted to say, you decide, you have a look what's right for you. Instead of saying, just call this number or just go there, instead of giving people three, four, five services, let's give people hundreds. And that's now being built into the biggest and most comprehensive mental health signposting tool of its kind in the UK now. So we've now got over 3,000 services on the Hub of Hope, and we're just continuing to build it. But we are changing the system. So we recently included in the government's Recovery Action Plan, COVID-19 Mental Health Recovery Action Plan, to saying go to the Hub of Hope. And only a couple of weeks ago, we were well. What I'll tell you, because I think this is actually quite important, the most viewed page on the NHS UK website, the most viewed page for mental health, is a page that says mental health charities. That's the most viewed page, not the NHS support, but the charities. There's the other alternative support. The most viewed page. But when I looked at that page, it was just a list. It was a list of 20, 30. What it is now is a direct link to the Hub of Hope. So they've removed that and they've got the Hub of Hope. And in 2 weeks, so our biggest ever amount of people that we've ever had access to Hub of Hope in a single month was in March 2020. And we had just over 5,500 people access the Hub of Hope in that month as a result of lockdown announcements. In 2 weeks, 2 weeks of being on the NHS UK webpage, from NHS UK alone, we had 8,000 people.
Wow.
In 2 weeks from the NHS alone. So what that shows is that how many people are looking for that other type of support, how many people need that help and support, and also how a simple platform like what we've created can change that system. But we've changed it and we've created it and we've built it from the ground without any real funding. We didn't have any funding, we didn't have any staff, didn't have any volunteers. We just had just me trying to do something because I felt like I had to. I had the responsibility and we just found it. And then we find a little bit of money and we can create something. We find a little bit more, we can build that. We can then bring somebody in to help and we build that gradually. Yes, it's taken time, but we've done it the right way. We've not rushed into it and we've done it with people in mind. And so with that passion, that drive and that absolute desire from lived experience to make a difference, we're changing the system. It's not something I often think about, really, how far we've come. But we have come a long way. But I just feel like it's not about me, and it's not about us. It's about all the other people who are out there as well, who have got lived experience, who from a place of loss and from a place of hurt and pain and suffering have said, I'm not standing for this anymore. And they've created something. Chasing a Stigma and a Hub of Hope is just one example of many of things that have been created by people saying, I'm not willing to let anybody else go through what I've gone through. And that is what I think has been the biggest difference in the last 5 to 5, 6 years, has been more and more services coming about because people say, I'm not just going to stand still. It almost feels like a revolution of people saying, well, if you're not going to help us, we'll do it ourselves. And there's so much more to offer out there for people. So no matter what you're going through, there's always something for you. It doesn't have to be a one size fits all approach.
Yeah, no, that's so true. I mean, there's so much to unpicking that. We live in this like information age, and we say we've got all this stuff at our fingertips, but it's not really. You know, I've been I've had a situation where I sat weirdly, now I think of it, in this very fucking spot in this kitchen, where just in the middle of the night, in the pits, scaring myself with my thoughts and desperately trying to find something online. And Google doesn't give you what you need, it gives you what it thinks you want, right? And just not being able to find, and although there was loads of stuff, none of it was what I was looking for. And that's why I was so fucking impressed when I stumbled across the Hub of Hope, because I was like, this is it. Like, this is it. It's one of those things, Matt. I bet when you kind of came up with the idea, you went, well, surely this must exist, right? Like, surely this must be out there.
Absolutely. From the day that I thought of it to the day that we launched it, and probably every day since, I've expected a phone call from somebody saying it's already existing. But what you've just said there is absolutely right. And I said this not long ago to somebody, is that you Google it and you can't find these services. If you can't Google something and find it, then what chance have we got? And this is potentially talking about looking for help for somebody else. If you're looking for help for yourself, then you honestly, the small, as you'll know, the smallest barrier, the smallest inconvenience is there. Oh, I couldn't be bothered. I'll leave it. I don't deserve it. Or it's a sign not to get it. So we wanted to remove that. We wanted to move those barriers. So that's why when you go on the Hub of Hope, you can either type in a postcode, you can type in a location, or you can just press a button that will use your device's location. We don't ask questions. You don't need to ask a question or answer a question about how you're feeling. You don't need to say who you are. You don't have to say your age. You don't have to have a login. It's just there. It's just there. And we just want to give people all the options. And then you can filter it. You can look for based on whether it's NHS, whether it's private, whether it's open now. You can look on concerns, whether it's anxiety or depression, PTSD. You can do all that once you're there. But what we were very conscious of was just saying, just give them the access, give them the information, and from there, allow them to find what they want to find. But we've got to just give people the options and give them the power to be able to look and decide based on what they feel they want to access. What we're not saying is don't go to a GP, and we're not saying don't go to a doctor, and we're not saying don't go to the crisis team, but we're saying here's the options that you do have. Because if you're on a waiting list, or if you go to a doctor and just given antidepressants, you can find other support as well. If you go to a counselor once a week, that's great. But if you feel like in the time between those sessions that you want to speak to somebody or you want to go to a group, you can do. What we're trying to do is we're trying to normalize that conversation around mental health, and we're trying to say, look at physical health. And I'd say one of the biggest differences between physical and mental health is that we see physical health as an aspiration. We see physical health as something that we can look after. We see it as something that we have control over. We see it as something that, look at schools. We all had PE. We knew what to do with PE. You go out, you run about. PE in my school was basically just them throwing a football at you and saying, go on, lads, just get on with that. But you know about it. You learn about it in science. You learn about your body. You learn about the things you can do. If you say the words physical health, you probably generally, as a society, have a positive image in your mind. You think of eating well, you think of exercising, you think of maybe an image of yourself that you want to aspire to be in peak physical health. But importantly, you know about the help and support that's available and what to do if you're struggling. When we say mental health, we only think of mental illness. If you say mental health, people roll their eyes because they think, well, it's depression, it's anxiety, it's suicide. We don't see mental health as something that we all have, and we don't see mental health as something that we can all look after. We should all be looking after our mental health on a daily basis. We should not just wait until we're unwell before we talk to somebody about mental health. If you're only putting signs for the Hub of Hope in doctors, and you're only putting stuff for the Hub of Hope in clinical environments, then in many ways, you're already talking to the people who probably already know about it. And that's why we've been teaming up with organisations like Network Rail, where we've had a national campaign with Network Rail, with NCP car parks, where we can get the Hub of Hope in everyday environments. I want you to know about the Hub of Hope when you're well. I want you to know about it when, if you've never had any mental health problems, because that's when we should be getting that message. So you should know about that, to know about the help and support to prevent you from getting to that crisis point. Finding that support earlier so that you can access it at an earlier stage and prevent yourself being unwell.
Yeah,
That's
man.
how we change.
Yeah, that's so powerful. And I think people would be really surprised, because I was really surprised how many services are in my local area. And when I say local, I mean like a mile. I mean walking distance. There was so many came up when I threw my postcode into that. And when it comes to getting help, it's not one size fits all. And to some extent, you have to find your tribe. You have to find the service that fits you as a personality. I talk a lot about My Black Dog, who are like a peer-to-peer support online. You may have heard of them. And when I found them, I was like, right, these are people that I could speak to if I needed, because of just the way they talked, because of the patrons they had involved. It just felt like a fit for me. Whereas when I was looking at the Samaritans, I couldn't bring myself to pick up that phone. And it's nothing, that's no slight on the Samaritans. They do amazing things. But for me, I was never going to make that call for what a myriad of reasons. But to find the one that works for you have to be able to find it. You have to be able to do this thing. And yeah, the amount that came up on that list in my local area was staggering. I had no idea about half of them.
Yeah, and no, I couldn't agree more. And just speaking on my personal experience as well, I was the same. I was suicidal, but still didn't feel like I could pick up the phone to any of these phone lines. As even being at that lowest point, I was like, well, it's not that bad, because it just didn't feel like that was me. And yeah, we do this for any other walk of life. We find the best fit. So it should be exactly the same with mental health and with mental health services that are out there, particularly within the third sector. There is the options, there's choices. You can find
Yeah.
what's right for you. So you need to give yourself that chance to have a look and to find the help and support. But then we also work closely with NHS England, who then provide us with their they've got recently commissioned 24-hour crisis phone lines. So yes, we have that as well. So if you need absolute emergency crisis support, that's on there. But also, there's loads of preventative stuff to go and have a look, and stuff that you can be doing every day, things that you can be doing once a week. You don't have to go through that route of that clinical side of things. It can just be, as you said, like just the peer support or a football team. There's a mental health football league where it's just people just playing football, but it's mental health related. They've gone through different things. Talk about a tribe. That's literally a team of people who have shared experience and help each other, support each other. So there's loads and loads of options.
Yeah, I suppose it's the difference between you know, we often look at like, what are the barriers to people asking for help, which is an important conversation to have. But we also know that those barriers maybe aren't as strong as we think, because people do ask for help, because the statistics are going up. And that's partly because more people are suffering, but it's also because more people are asking for help. Yeah. What I loved kind of about what you guys are doing is that stepping away from the why, what's getting in the way of people asking for help conversation, it's the like, what's stopping people getting the help conversation. And that kind of like flips the whole thing on its head. But yeah, I thought it was absolutely fantastic, man. So you mentioned the network rail thing. I watched the video the other night. It's a nice little cheeky cameo from you at the end there, mate.
Yeah.
But what's next? What are your plans moving forward for the app and for the charity?
World domination. There's absolutely nothing off limits. We want the Hub of Hope in particular to be, we want it to be the nation's go-to signposting tool, which in many ways it already is, but we want it to be common knowledge in every household up and down the country. And we've got a training program which again we developed ourselves here, in which we try to train everybody in an organization and outside of businesses, rather than a select few. We want in schools, we're just looking at developing our school program. We want to access as many people as we possibly can. We want to work with as many people as we possibly can. And we want consistency. We want consistent message around signposting. I don't want to see people sharing a list of like 4 or 5 services. I want there to be a consistent message across all different services, to say, here's where you can go and find all that help and support. And you know what, as an organisation, we're growing. As I said, being on NHS webpage and the amount of people that we're getting, being included in government reports, having partnerships with Network Rail and with NCP car parks, doing all the things that we're doing is amazing, but we still depend almost entirely on public donations to exist. Like, despite our importance, we're not currently receiving any grants. We're not receiving any financial support from government or from NHS at the moment. And so we need to continue to grow. So yes, we have team here now, we have staff here now, but we want to just grow the Hub of Hope, grow the expand on the actual digital side of it, but expand the amount of services in there. We know that 3,000 is a lot, but we know that it's only tip of the iceberg. So it's just growth. It's trying to make this everywhere. And as I said, working with as many organizations as we can to make this part of a normal everyday life.
Yeah. And, you know, like I said at the start, but like the first thing that I thought was like, this is fucking vital. This is so important. It's everything that's, you know, people have kind of, you know, people have talked about things. It's all the things people talk about all in one place. And I was just blown away by it. It's kind of, do you remember when U2 brought that album out and everyone with an iPhone got it, whether they wanted it or not? Should get some of that Bono technology, man, and get it so it just pops up on people's new phones.
Yeah, I don't even think you could delete it, could you?
I think I've still got it. But Jake, mate, that was awesome. Thank you so much for your time. I really, really appreciate it. And I'll put all the links to Chasing the Stigma and Hub of Hope in the episode notes and all that sort of stuff. And anyone listening, just go and check them out and spread the word, because it's important. And it's just brilliant. Thank you, mate. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening from the Proper Mental Podcast. Please like and subscribe.
Plus 5 stars.